Welcome to The Curious Sheep, the podcast for everything sheep. We'll ask questions, challenge ideas, learn from each other, and share the wonderful world of farming and all the fun that goes with it. Whether you're a seasoned pro at shepherding, just bought your first sheep, or live in the city and are curious about farming, I hope you can gain some knowledge for your own farm or a tidbit of farm info to share at your next dinner party. Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Curious Sheep Podcast. This episode, I catch up with Carrie Woolley. Carrie is the head of a large flock of sheep, and we talk about some really cool things that she's doing. If you're looking to think outside the box and get some ideas for how to get more out of your acres using sheep. So we talk about silvopasture, grazing orchards. She's even got a flock of geese now that she's added into the mix. So I hope you can all gain some insight from her operation and how she does things. And maybe you too can find some ways to expand or do some different things on your farm as well. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Curious Sheep Podcast. This week, I am joined by Carrie Woolley. How are you, Carrie?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing, Romy?
Awesome. And your real name is actually Woolley, which is hilarious because you're a sheep farmer. I always found that really amusing. You probably get that a lot.
Yes, I've had people ask if I actually changed my last name to Woolley, which I did not.
Yeah, and I told you that when you got married that you were allowed to change your name.
Yeah, so yeah, when I got married, I just kept I kept my last name of Woolley.
Yeah, we met, how many years was it ago now? We did the Master Shepherd's course together.
Yeah, that was quite a few years ago.
There was, I had maybe babies and you had no babies. And
yeah, I don't know what, I guess that was like, maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, that sounds right. Time flies, eh?
Yeah, that was a really good course. I really liked it.
Yeah, I always tell everyone that that if you're looking into any sort of substantial or serious take at sheep farming, that you should take it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So to start, tell me a little bit about your family and the farm.
All right. Well, my husband, Brett, and I, we have two young children, Emma and Elliot. They're 2 and 3. And Brett and I both farm alongside his family on their family farm operation, Skylar Farms. So it's Brett, my husband, and his brother Ryan, and their father Marshall, and their uncle Drew, and so it is quite a family farm operation with a bunch of us, and a bunch of other full-time employees as well.
Mm-hmm. Describe the farm maybe at the point where you came into it, because the sheep was kind of your baby that you brought
yeah
in, right?
Yeah, so when I joined the farm operation, I was finishing up my master's degree at Guelph. There, I guess right when I was finishing up, we had played around with sheep a little bit, grazing the orchards, but we were using sheep from a neighbor's farm just to see how it would work. It was a bit of an experiment, and we thought it worked well. So that was where I came along. When I finished my master's degree, I decided to actually do our own flock and have our own sheep, and that would fit nicely with the rest of the farm operation. So the farm operation that was already in existence was a grain operation growing corn and soybeans, and orchards growing apples and sour cherries.
Where's the farm located? You guys have kind of a cool spot.
Yeah, so we are in Norfolk County. So we're pretty close to Lake Erie. We are quite a garden here in Ontario, so there are some large tracts of sand, some really nice loam soils, and then as you head towards Haldimand, you get into clay. But a lot of our farms are quite sandy or a bit of a loam. Especially the cherry trees, they do well on sandy ground. So, it's kind of a neat spot in Ontario here where there's lots of vegetable and fruit farms.
And tell me a bit about your sheep, the kind of sheep you have and the production system you're running.
So our sheep are a commercial, I guess, composite mix. A lot of our sheep are a half Coopworth, quarter Border Cheviot, quarter Romanov. And we are starting to get quite a few ewes in the flock now that are more towards a purebred Coopworth. We had imported two lines of Coopworth semen from New Zealand 2 or 3 years ago, and so we've been using Coopworth rams to make our breeding ewes, so ending up with a lot more Coopworth in the flock, and that is because those genetics are favored towards a grass-based system, which is what we are. So we are just an annual pasture lambing system where we're just lambing once a year on grass in May and June. And our sheep spend their entire life, their entire year outside, primarily on pasture, and also on corn stover, but we have no housing for our sheep. They're just outside year round.
And the Coopworth, they're the white sheep with the dark noses and dark hooves, right? The dark hooves help with the whole being on pasture.
Yeah, we do like to favor black nose, black feet. And yeah, white wool, white faces, clean face. They're kind of a medium-sized sheep. But yeah, just trying to have a nice hardy low maintenance animal that can survive out on pasture and hopefully produce twins. And maybe some decent wool too.
Yeah. I noticed we've got some Coopworth in some of the maternal crosses that we have. And I always notice when she's got a bit more Coopworth in it, I can always see in the wool, it's a little shinier.
Okay.
I can kind of tell it's still very lofty and fluffy, like a Dorset would be, but it's got a different shine to it.
Yeah, they have really nice fleeces for the most part. Is what we've found. Not that I know that much about wool, but yeah, Donna Hancock at Wellington Fiber Mill, she seems to quite like when we have some nice Coopworth fleeces for her.
Mm-hmm. Any way we can use more wool, it's good. And what is your cycle? When do you breed? When do you lamb? What are some of those details?
So rams go out on December 15th. We pull the rams out after two cycles. So then we're lambing. We usually start having some lambs by about around the 10th of May or just a little bit before. And yeah, that'll be heavy for like 2 to 3 weeks. And then we wean in early August. It's kind of nice timing. We wean the lambs out onto the cherry orchards and it's nice clean ground. And then in the fall, we start to sell off lambs. And some of the lambs end up just being sold live off the farm. Some of them we take to the butcher shop for our direct marketing. And then some get held back for replacement stock. That's our system. It seems pretty simple for like a year round thing.
Mm-hmm. And are you doing teasers or anything, or do you just count on those ewes being sort of ready to go?
Yeah, we don't use any teaser rams. We just hope that it's their natural time of year to get pregnant, and mm-hmm. we usually have pretty good pregnancy rates. So,
yeah. Good. Do you give them a chance to rebreed, or if they can't make that work and it's not with your system?
Yeah, I've kind of been mixed. Like at first, for the first couple of years, I was getting rid of mature ewes if they didn't get pregnant. And then the last couple of years here, I've held on to them more so because we were trying to really grow the flock. Not that you really want to hold on to open ewes and stuff, but it's been a mix though. I think a couple of years ago, I took a bunch of the open ewes and then turned them into sausage for our direct marketing of lamb and stuff. So it kind of depends on if I've got a market for them or if I decide that there's few enough of them, I'll just hold on to them.
Yeah, your direct marketing, it is called Woolly's Lamb, so believe it or not, right? Tell us a little bit about your marketing and some of the branding you've done with that.
Oh, yeah, that's been quite the experience sort of trying to get into the world of direct marketing and catering to restaurants and all that fun stuff. But yeah, a few years ago we had local restaurants asking if we had product to sell. They liked our story and they liked that the lamb is local, and so we decided to build a brand, Woolly's Lamb. And yeah, so at first we were really catering more to the restaurants. And then over the last year and a bit here, we started to shift towards the online marketing. And then as it happened with COVID, it was kind of a good move because as COVID hit and restaurants had to shut down, that restaurant trade really took a nosedive. So it's been interesting. It was a bit tricky trying to deal with some of that stuff, trying to sell your product, market it and distribute it to restaurants, and different chefs would have different opinions on how they want things cut, or they don't want it frozen, or all of that kind of fun stuff. So yeah, I think we're going to maybe stick to what we have now, that doing a little more of just like the direct marketing, where you can order online and we ship it straight to your door.
Cool. How do you ship?
So the meat gets shipped in a cardboard box that has a liner in it, and ice packs. So, and Purelator can do your stuff where they get it to their doorstep the next day. So just making sure you got lots of cold packs in it in the summertime.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. You wouldn't want to touch those packages with can of post someday. Your fruit trees, how often or when do you put the sheep through the fruit tree orchards, and how is that benefiting? Does it benefit the trees or the management of the orchards that way? I know you don't have to go in and mow between the orchards, but is there any other benefits to having the sheep do that
way? For other benefits, I mean, obviously putting down that manure in those orchards is a good thing. You know, as far as measuring some of that stuff, it's some of these things are pretty hard to measure. Although we have, there was the 1 year we were doing soil sampling, and there was a chunk of orchard with really high organic matter in one area. And the guys were scratching their head trying to figure out for a while, looking at the soil maps, why this one orchard or part of an orchard was so high. And then they realized that that was where I had overwintered the sheep the previous winter. But as far as some of the other benefits, you know, you hear people talking about it can help with some of like the fungal infections and keeping fungus spores, keeping the levels down and some of that stuff. It's a bit hard to measure. So, but in terms of when you can actually put the sheep into the orchards, we only put them in after we've harvested the orchards. So, for the sour cherries, we can go into the orchards right around August 1st is usually, we're usually done harvesting cherries by then. And then for the apples start to get picked, I'll say around September 1st or so. And so same thing, we can start going into the orchards around that time, but only after the fruit has been harvested. Not only is that just purely for management, but also like food safety wise, that's frowned upon to have livestock grazing in orchards when there's fruit. So you have to watch with that in the springtime as well, once you start getting buds are actually getting small fruit growing. But that at that time we're into permanent pastures. So but yeah, like I was saying, it's a nice time of year. Like August 1st, that's right around when we want to start weaning lambs, or even like a week into August. And so then it opens up a nice window that we can move lambs into the orchards, and we haven't grazed that orchard all year, so it's clean ground from a parasite point of view, and get them off those permanent pastures that are starting to get high loads of parasites potentially.
For your, is there a difference in the grass species that you're using on your permanent pasture or in your orchards?
So it's a bit of a mixed bag. So some of our permanent pastures, some of them we have done no seeding at all. And then some of them, I guess more so the silvopastures, we have done some seeding in the silvopastures of a mix of like trefoil, clover, orchard grass. I think that was the mix. And then in the orchards, it's similar, it's a mixed bag. So some of the orchards are actually like 30 to 40 years old, and so we are just grazing whatever is already growing there, and we've done no seeding. And then in some of our younger orchards that we've been planting in the last couple of years, we have started planting a pasture or hayfield mix into those orchards. So depending on the soil type, some of our young orchards we've actually planted, we've seeded down alfalfa, timothy, clover, trefoil, and that partially also is because we are making hay in those orchards. So a lot of our winter feed is baleage out of the younger orchards.
So are you having to plan those orchards different for the spacing between the trees so you can make hay easily? Or was that spacing already
Yeah, the
working?
spacing's already working. Yeah, basically the orchard is like the primary focus, and doing the planting, like the spacings that the guys want for those trees. And then if we can get equipment through there, then we will. So it gets a little bit tight in some of the apple orchards, but the cherry orchards, the spacing is quite wide because those are all mechanically harvested cherries. So the spacing has to be pretty big and wide already just for that equipment.
I was listening to a podcast a while ago about, I think he was in the UK, and he was planning on doing, I forget what the term is, but it's using trees and then doing your spacing so you could do small grains or hay in between. And he was talking about the say if you planted barley between your rows of trees or hay, that crop, it takes or it doesn't grow maybe quite as good because the trees use some, but working with those together, you still get sort of the same outcome as far as like profit off of the do you figure those hay fields or the grass between the trees, do you think there is any sort of decrease in there, or is it just a big mutually beneficial little ecosystem where everything benefits, and now you're just able to get lamb
off
of it?
I think it is that scenario. I think that you're getting like a mutually beneficial system happening. Because we can see some pretty nice yields, especially these are young orchards, so the trees aren't huge and they're still getting lots of sunlight onto that grass, that forage. So like some of those orchards are getting really nice. We're getting some nice bales coming out of that, and then we're also growing a tree and we're not worried about negatively impacting that tree, because that is number one, is that the trees cannot be negatively impacted by the sheep operation, whether it's grazing or making hay. But yeah, it would be neat to see down the road some of these orchards as they get a little bit older and the trees get more mature and you start harvesting crops off of the trees as well, to see what yields look like, especially with some of these orchards that we hay in the summer and then we come through and hit them pretty hard with sheep grazing later in the fall and putting down all that manure and stuff. But yeah, right now it just seems like a mutually beneficial system for us, where we can make some really nice hay and then also be confident that our tree crop there is not being negatively impacted.
Yeah, I think it's just such a different way of thinking. I think most farmers are very, we like boxes, right? Like, we are going to have a 20 acre field of hay over here, and if we have apple trees, we'll have a 20-acre field of apple trees over here, where if we put it together but still make it work for harvesting, if that's, you know, if we want to harvest hay or small grains, but putting them together, I think, can have a lot of other benefits versus having them in their own little boxes. Like, it's a really cool way to, like, it's so different, and it just makes all kinds of wheels turn. It gets me thinking about, like, what else can we change, or like, what else have we been doing for so many years that we should think of it differently?
Yeah, no, it is really neat. Yeah, it's totally changed the way that I think about things. You're driving through the countryside and you're looking like, oh, hey, you could, I could put sheep out there and I could mix these two together. Like, I wonder what would happen if we tried grazing this crop. And yeah, I don't know, it's interesting because it is such a different way of thinking for over here and for this time period. But when I used to talk to my grandmother, she would talk about how they would graze the pigs through the orchard. But that was, I don't know what that would have been, 70 plus years ago. But it is interesting now how agriculture does seem, like you say, into such boxes. Like, okay, I grow this, and this is how many acres of this, and then down the road, I have this field. And like, yeah, this sort of intercropping or multi-cropping and sort of overlapping of things. Yeah, it's just kind of it's neat when those things come together too, and like you say, they're mutually beneficial. They both work together. So yeah, it's definitely it's fun to think about some of the different possibilities and opportunities.
And one of the other really cool things that you're doing, and you have mentioned it before already, can you talk about what silvopasture is and what you guys are
Yeah,
doing with that?
so silvopasture is the practice of integrating trees and forages for grazing livestock, and it's so that it's in a mutually beneficial way. So you're both trying to have a crop from the trees and have a crop from the livestock that are grazing amongst the trees.
It wouldn't necessarily be like your fruit trees. Like it could be just, it's not necessarily a tree that we would get like a
That's
produce
right.
or
That's
something out
right.
of.
So it could be just a wood lot. I say just, it could be a wood lot where you're trying to have timber production. You're trying to have a tree crop that is profitable. And then yeah, also having your forages that are growing so that you can graze livestock in that wood lot. And it needs to be an extensively or not extensively, intensively managed system. So that, as I say, that it's mutually beneficial to both the tree crop and the livestock. So I guess in terms of the sheep world, basically you need to be doing rotational grazing in these systems so that your livestock aren't destroying the trees that you want to be profitable from as well.
And what kind of area are you guys doing silvopasture in? That's not the fruit
Yeah,
trees.
so
You do another area, right?
we have a couple hundred acres of woodlot that we use for silvopasture. We had when we were starting to grow the sheep operation and outgrow some of our other permanent pastures, we started sort of looking around at what other possibilities or opportunities we had already. And the farm already owned a few hundred acres of woodlots that were not being really managed at all. They were just kind of seen as just kind of as a side piece on a farm, and just left to their own. And then we started hearing about silvopasture. So it's a bit of a process to get your fencing up and run divider fences so that you can rotationally graze. But they've turned into some really beautiful and actually very very practical and functional parts of our sheep operation. So yeah, we have, I'd say, about just over 200 acres right now that we are grazing for silvopasture.
That's so neat. And sort of the perimeter, and how big are your sections in there?
Usually I try and keep the sections I kept the sections very large when we first started grazing the woodlots, because before we started thinning out trees and seeing a lot of forage growth, some of the areas would be quite big, like close to 10 acres. Just because there wasn't much forage growing, and I didn't want small sections where I was moving sheep all the time. But now as our silvopastures get more productive, I like to keep the areas smaller. So keeping spots to just like a few, like 3 to 5 acres at a time.
That would you move the sheep every day in those?
It'd be closer to, it depends on how the forages are doing, but sort of, you'd be probably be moving them, it really depends. Like, you might be moving them after like just a few days, or if I've stocked the number of animals kind of low and the grass is doing really well and it got ahead of them, then they might be there for close to a week or so, which I don't really like to do. But
and it sounds all easy, just put a fence around the forest. You might have some issues some bylaws, so, right?
I guess the first part of it was that we didn't realize you needed to get a permit to dig a ditch in a woodlot. So that was the first thing. So some of these spots were pretty waterlogged. Some of these woodlots, partially because they would sort of dam up around the woodlots and didn't really care about it previously. So anyways, we had spots that were really waterlogged, so we did a bunch of ditching and found out that you need to get a permit to dig a ditch in a woodlot. So that's fine. And then we, I don't know, it's a bit of a mixed bag thing here. So in Norfolk County, they take pride in that we have the Carolinian forest around here. And back, I don't even know what it would have been, but like decades ago, guys just started like clearing farms, and because of the ground being so sandy, there were farms where literally like feet of topsoil or sand would blow away. And so then after that, they realized, okay, we need to have trees on some of this land here. And so it's been a big project of sort of protecting some of the woodlots across Norfolk County. And so people get pretty sensitive about cutting down trees in this area. And our local forestry bylaw division was pretty sensitive about that. So they, what we were doing was mulching trees, a lot of stuff that was already dead or had fallen down, but we were going through with a professional forestry mulcher and actually grinding up some of these trees and stuff that had been marked by a professional forester. So it wasn't just us cruising through the woodlot bulldozing over trees. We did take the proper steps to have a professional forester mark, you know, specific trees that need to stay, or some that can get taken down for firewood, or some that are just garbage and just need to be taken out. So we were following the proper procedures, but yeah, our people in our forestry bylaw division were pretty keen to jump on us, and they didn't like some of the excessive tree damage that happens when you drive an excavator through a woodlot for ditching, and when you drive a professional forestry mulcher through a forest. You end up dinging, like, it's pretty hard to not sometimes scratch up against other trees, and so they were trying to get after us pretty bad on that. And then that all got dropped. Like, they had tried to charge us over excessive damage, but that stuff got dropped. But yeah, they were pretty sensitive to it, and I think they also just didn't like us. But I could go on for a while about that, but so yeah, that was just a bit of an adventure for us. But we are working really hard to make sure we're doing things properly, and yeah, and you know, the goal is for it to remain as a woodlot, but to take the garbage trees out, get the junk out, so that we can grow grasses as well, is the whole objective. Mm-hmm. There.
So the takeaway from Carrie would be to make sure you know what your bylaws are in your area, because they're going to be different wherever you are, right? And essentially, yep. At the end, I mean, you are creating likely more biodiversity and a better environment in that area, especially if it was, you know, if the landscaping or if they moved some dirt around the edge of it and that water direction and flow got changed to begin with, if you're helping to reverse some of that, you're going to get a better outcome in the end.
I mean, you can look at it different ways and say, you know, you're taking away from a habitat that the rabbits preferred and the raccoons preferred. But then we can go on the flip side and say, we're now creating a habitat that other, you know, that songbirds prefer, and that game birds and some of these protected species that, like the Carolinian forest, that's actually a little bit more open, they prefer that habitat that we're creating now. So it's hard though when you see the pictures of the sheep in the woodlot and there's like birds singing out there, and like it's hard to say that that's bad for the environment.
Yeah. And we have plenty of raccoons, so there's no worry about losing
Yeah.
Good. And with how many sheep you've got, you do have a little bit of help with the orchard. The farm has always had help from some other countries. So you guys use the temporary farm worker program, right?
Yep.
And then you're able to use them when you need them for the sheep, and everyone kind of helps where is needed. Or do you have certain help that really likes the sheep, or how do you do that?
Yeah, so when I started to need extra help quite a few years back, and I wanted someone helping me, it was a little bit of a trial and error thing to see who likes sheep, who wants to work with them. I quite quickly found Timothy was the first guy helping me. And he had some experience from back home, and he just turned out to be a great worker. And so he comes up every year, along with another guy that helps me, Omadath. They come up every year around March, and then they are allowed to stay for, is it 8 or 9 months on the worker program? So then they go home for the winter time, which actually works out really well for us because the winter is not as busy and I don't need as much help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have quite a few workers on the farm from Trinidad and Tobago. And recently we've been getting workers from Jamaica. Just wonderful people. And it works out really well that if we have a day, say shearing days or days when we're weaning and we're trying to transport animals to different farms, there's lots of people around, usually. So I can usually grab a couple extra people as well. And so we have lots of people around, and it really helps with some of those big jobs.
Mm-hmm. You said he has some experience from, was he from Jamaica?
Trinidad.
Do they have some sheep there that he's got experience with? I should interview him.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah. I find quite a few of these people back home. They have livestock. They were raised with some goats and some sheep, and are even working with cattle and ox. So it's really nice that they have some hands-on experience and knowledge already. And yeah, it's great.
Do you know what kind of sheep they have?
Is it the Barbados Black Belly? I think is the name of the breed.
That's a hair breed, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's really neat that they can use those skills too. That's really helpful.
Yeah.
And I know there'd be a lot to dig into with the worker program and all of the stuff you guys have had to deal with as a farm and COVID and all of that. You said that you're doing a lot of advocacy work. And do you want to just give us a brief little snippet? And I'll be sure to post the link to some of those articles too, because I think it's some really important stuff that people need to know about.
Keep it brief. It's, it was a different world. With COVID and trying to function without workers or dealing with all the quarantine stuff and all the extras. We started off the springtime not being able to get workers up for a while. That was tricky. And then when they came to our farm, they had to quarantine. They could only have 3 people per bunkhouse, so we had to have people spread out all over the county in different spots. And then we had an outbreak in the fall after apple harvest, and it was just very difficult trying to make sure everyone was happy. Trying to make sure workers felt comfortable, trying to make sure our health unit was happy. my husband Brett sort of took it on as a personal project last year to stand up for what he believed in and stand up for workers' rights. And it was a big commitment on his part, but we're just doing what we think is right for these people. And still dealing with some of that stuff. Our health unit thinks that it's, or the, our medical officer of health thinks it's okay to lock guys into hotel rooms for 2 weeks and not be allowed outside at all for even 10 minutes of fresh air a day. And we don't think that's right. So we're back at it again this year before the spring even rolls around here. We're already trying to figure out how to deal with those things. So,
It's the whole COVID and everything has brought up so many issues or just aspects that are so important for agriculture in, I mean, any part of the world, right? Is we count on these people or the movement of people and labor and very skilled labor to do the jobs of harvesting our food. And if you can't get them here, right? Like there were stories of, I think the biggest one was it maybe just asparagus, because that was one of the first crops is, right?
Yep.
Asparagus went bad in the field because we weren't allowed to get the workers into the country.
Yeah, we sprayed about 70 acres of asparagus last year in the springtime because we did not have workers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was really sad to sort of see that side of people where they said, oh, well, you know, you just find locals and, you know, no big deal. Just go find a bunch of local people to do the work. And it's just disappointing. Like, these guys come up and they are skilled labor. Like, these guys have been doing this for years, for decades. They work hard. They're skilled. They know how to run equipment. They know how to fix equipment. They know how to problem solve. Like, and they're willing to do the work. And this Canadian agriculture, especially the hort industry, totally depends on that workforce. And I don't think people see the value in it, and I don't think people appreciate those people. And I, you know, it's a little bit scary. I don't know if people high up in government, you know, understand it or appreciate it and realize that our food system depends on these workers coming up and doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. It just makes you really appreciate the people involved in the system. So hopefully you guys can get the workers that you expect or that you need. And a lot of them come year after year, right?
Yeah, we have people that have been working on this farm for over 20 years. Even a couple people that have worked on this farm for 30 plus years. So yeah, you really get to know the people, and they're like family. They're like friends, they're family. They're just, you get to know them really well, and it's really nice.
I was just thinking, there's two more critters I want to ask you about. Do you want to tell me about your geese? I love seeing your geese on social media.
Yeah, they're entertaining. Yeah, that was just an experiment that we did 2 years ago. We had, I don't know what that was, about 10 or 15 geese that we wanted to try raising out on the pasture, and it worked pretty well. So then last year we got 100 goslings, and they're just really neat. They, after about 6 or 7 weeks, they can not only survive but thrive on a grass only diet. So they become like feathered sheep, and we would put them out with our sheep, and they would rotationally graze and just eat forage, get fat, and then we butchered them in the fall or early winter.
Cool. And they probably eat all kinds of bugs and things like that. Are they eating different grasses than the sheep?
Yeah, I did notice that. What was it? Oh, I know. I noticed that they were eating Jack in the Pulpit out in the woodlot, and the sheep never eat that, but the geese were loving it. So it was kind of neat that they were going for some different stuff, but then they also really like clover and but yeah, they're neat. They're a, well, what are they? A white Danish goose. And that's sort of their thing is they're pretty calm, they're pretty tame goose, and they they're raised for meat, and they do well on forage only. So we're gonna do that again this year. We've ordered 300 for this year. So
awesome. That's gonna be fun to see. Do they stay as one group?
They did this past year. I left them all as one group. I don't know what I'm gonna do this year. I might split them up.
Yeah, I always wish, like, our farm here, it's like a flat 100 acres with square fields, and I think it'd be so cool to have some variety, or like a woodlot that we could use, or different, so a little bit of different landscape. That's one of maybe on my bucket list, is if we ever get a different farm or something, is have the opportunity to do some kind of cool stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I guess the last critter is the dogs. You count on the dogs a lot, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they're sort of an integral part of our sheep operation. So we have about 12 guard dogs. We depend on them, because I'm sure we would have a lot of losses to coyotes if we didn't have them. So they can be a bit of work to look after, but I think that they're pretty critical if you're going to do pastured sheep.
Dogs are definitely something you need to plan. It's another type of flock you have to manage in a way, because, and especially with as many as you have, there's definitely different personalities you probably have to deal with, or certain dogs that you know can work together or not, or how do you split them up?
No, you're absolutely right. So there's different personalities, and some dogs don't like to get along with others, and so you kind of learn who works well together. And then in the spring and summertime, we can have upwards of like 10 to 12 groups of sheep, which sounds kind of crazy and is. So like we'll have like 10 different farms with sheep on them. So that is why I have a ridiculous amount of guard dogs, is so that I have at least one dog at each spot. I kind of go with, if it's a small group and they're doing really small grazing areas, I'll put like an older dog so they don't have to work as hard. Or if it's a really big group, that gets larger paddocks for grazing, and it's, you know, some spots are really rolly, then I'll put a team of dogs there, like two together. So, we kind of just go with, who works well together and which farms need more protection.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to share about the farm? That it didn't miss anything?
Oh, I don't think so.
There's lots going on. What's next? What's the future plans?
Oh my goodness. I need a rest.
You're getting more peace.
Oh my goodness. After I have a rest, more geese, more sheep. We want to keep increasing the flock. Like we're just over 800 ewes right now, and we want to get to around 1,000. So I think we'll be there next year after we keep a bunch of replacements this fall. I don't know. I want to just enjoy some family time this year. My gosh.
COVID, isn't that what COVID was supposed to do, right? We were supposed to have
film. Yeah, we got to sit at home and hang out with our kids. Oh man, yeah, no, this farm had the biggest expansion of its history about 3 months before COVID hit. So it would be really nice just to get into a groove of things. Like, we purchased a neighboring farm operation that was about 700 acres. So we're just trying to get systems in place so that things are being handled a little more, I don't want to say properly, but, you know, getting a proper HR person set up on the farm and getting some more managers, like maybe a shop manager and another, we already hired like an operations manager so that, because prior to that, it was basically, Brett and his dad, Marshall, being the operations manager for, 4,000 acres. And it just, and there, you know, and Brett was basically like HR, for all the problems with, the 90 workers. And it'd just be nice to get some more people in place so that we're not running ourselves crazy and having it more manageable.
Yeah. So just, yeah, time will help you ease into the expansion. And once all of that figured out, you can kind of relax a little bit or let it. And right, running a new piece of land too, you have to, you know, schedule all that in and make it work too.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't have too huge of plans, but just to, just get things a little bit more manageable and, deal with another year of COVID and.
Yeah. Trying to go on a vacation or something, if possible.
Pardon?
Maybe try and go on a vacation, if at all possible, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. Just a breather, just something.
Yeah. You'll get them. What is Carrie's favorite lamb recipe?
Ooh, you know what? One of my favorites, and I love it because it's like a kind of a cut that I think is underrated, is I like to do neck chops and just put them in a slow cooker with some hard cider and some rosemary and some onion and garlic. And just let that simmer away for the day. That's probably one of my favorites.
Do you have any favorite sheep resources or books that you go to or that you want to share?
Oh, that's a good, question. Not Google. Yeah, I'm trying to think, what do I normally use? The winter time is awesome because we don't have like bacteria and parasites in sheep. So like I haven't had hardly any sick sheep lately. My vet is a good go-to. Have a good vet relationship. What's the one? It's like New Zealand Beef and Lamb. Sometimes they have some really neat articles to look at or videos to watch.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It took us a while to organize to get together to do this, but I appreciate it. And I think everyone will definitely get some awesome ideas and get some brains thinking about what is all possible with sheep.
Cool. Thank you for having me. Thanks for having me on the podcast, Romy.
Thanks for tuning in, and make sure you head on over to Instagram to follow us at Circle Our Lamb, where I'll be posting links to the episodes, as well as the show notes and any related tip sheets and materials. Feel free to ask any questions or give us suggestions for future episodes. Thanks, and happy farming!